Hi everyone, Sam here. Thanks for listening to the Policy Dispatch. Before we get on with the show, just a quick word on how you can access the rest of our unmissable and informative journalism on Foresight Climate and Energy. If you'd like to enjoy premium access to this or any of our other podcasts, as well as our in-depth articles, you can. You can try us for 30 days for less than €1 a day, which will give you access to our website and app. Just follow the link in the show notes or go to www.foresightmedia.com to find out more. Join our global community of listeners and readers today to stay informed, entertained, and in the know about all things climate and energy. Hello and welcome to the Policy Dispatch. I'm Sam Morgan, your host and navigator through the exciting and fascinating world of the energy transition. On this week's episode, we have a very special treat for you, as I'm going to be joined by Swiss adventurer Bertrand Piccard, the first person to circumnavigate the globe in a hot air balloon. Bertrand followed up that feat by becoming the first person to pilot a solar-powered plane around the world, and is hoping to do it all again in an aircraft fueled with hydrogen. These aren't just the exploits of an adrenaline junkie, though. Bertrand wants to change the way the world works, and how the status quo preserves some of the very worst aspects of our society, particularly when it comes to the energy transition. Fed up with being told that's impossible or that can't be done, Bertrand has time and time again proven his doubters wrong. In 2028, when his world's first hydrogen flight is scheduled to make its landmark journey, Bertrand aims to do it all again. Before we get into the discussion, time for the obligatory Policy Dispatch quiz question. Back in 1999, when Bertrand Piccard flew around the world non-stop in the Breitling Orbiter, he and his fellow pilot set a number of records, one of which was the longest unrefueled flight time in history. It's a record that still stands. How long was the aircraft up in the skies? Was it A, 12 days, 4 hours and 19 minutes? B, 15 days, 2 hours and 6 minutes? C, 19 days, 21 hours and 17 minutes? Or D, 23 days, 17 hours and 3 minutes. Answer as always after the show. So, Bertrand, thank you so much for joining me today. Been looking forward to this discussion for a long time, I must admit. I remember watching your circumnavigation of the globe in hot air balloon on the news back when I was in school. And then when I was in university, eagerly following your exploits with solar powered flight. So it's really great to be able to talk to you about what comes next.
With pleasure, Sam.
Perhaps I can just start by asking you about this next big endeavor then, Climate Impulse, and your bid to go around the world in a hydrogen-powered aircraft. What's the objective of this project? And I suppose, more importantly for this discussion, what kind of impact would you like this project to have on the energy transition?
It's a call against pessimism, against defeatism, against this dangerous ideology that there is no future on Earth, that there are no solutions. All this is completely wrong. I want to show that there are solutions. I want to show that there is hope, that there is possible action. And flying around the world nonstop in a hydrogen-powered airplane, when everybody thinks it's impossible, I believe is really important, because we have to show that we can do much more than what people think.
Do you feel like at the moment that we are in danger then of going into this downward trend of, like you say, defeatism and basically pessimism and not really caring about where we're going in the world and making progress?
There are two very dangerous trends. One trend comes from some green activists who say there is no future, everything's lost, we need to degrow the economy, destroy the system, which is just not realistic, because even if you do it in Europe, how do you want the other continents to stop their development? Their only wish is to be as developed as we are. So it's very theoretical. And now the other dangerous trend comes from some politicians or from the industry who continues to say the ecological transition is too expensive, it's detrimental to our economical development, it obliges us to make some sacrifice. and they resist. So you have the one who promote the wrong message, the others who are resisting against the ecological transition. And we have to show that it's really something different. It's about modernizing our world, to make it more efficient, to replace what is polluting by what is protecting the environment. This will create new jobs. It will allow an economical development, but in a qualitative way and not a quantitative way. Because today, the goal is to sell as much as we can at cheaper prices with low salaries and a lot of social inequalities. And this makes pollution because there's a lot of waste, a lot of wasted energy, a lot of wasted resources, food, everything is wasted in our world. So we need to replace this by a world with a qualitative economy where you have a circular system, circular economy, where you have better products and basically where you sell efficiency. And it's a word that I really want to put forward because efficiency is everything that allows you to do better with a smaller consumption. So you consume less energy, less resources, but you obtain a better result. So it's better for the economy and it's better for the environment. And it's also better, socially speaking.
Correct me if I'm wrong, but the flight is supposed to take off in 2028, if that's right.
Now we have 2 years of construction. There will be 2 years of test. And the flight, exactly, is planned for 2028.
And what kind of world, if it's not too difficult to ask, do you think that this flight will take off from? Do you think it will be one that's desperately in need of a big success story like this? Or do you hope that it will be more the cherry on the cake, if you will, and you'll ride a wave of optimism in a way? Or do you think that it won't?
It would be fantastic to imagine that it's the cherry on the cake, that the world will already be efficient, already be running on renewable energies. But let's be serious. It's in 5 years. And I think in 5 years, it's a world that will be even more desperate about putting hope, putting action, focusing much more on clean technologies and clean energies also.
If I can ask you maybe a bit more about the technicalities of the project, because we've obviously seen companies like Airbus in the last couple of years talk about hydrogen-powered flight and how they're working on that and the challenges and so forth. What kind of technical hurdles are we talking about with this project? Are they ones that you see as being easy to overcome and to show people that this isn't a theoretical technology, this is something that we can do and we can do it by 2028?
Nothing is easy when it's done for the first time. And I would even say that everything is impossible until it has been achieved. So it was like this with the Wright brothers. It was scientifically proven that a heavier than air could not fly. Only balloons could have the buoyancy. And then it was discovered that if you have speed on the wing profile, it creates the lift. So a new paradigm was invented at that moment. So it's exactly the same now. We need to build an airplane around the liquid hydrogen tanks because the hydrogen needs to be kept at minus 253 degrees Celsius, which is very close to the absolute zero. So the tanks have to be very, very well insulated. And the little bit of hydrogen that is evaporating anyway, which you call the boil-off, will be captured in the fuel cells to be transformed into electricity and feed two electric motors. So all the plane is around that. And for the people who want to imagine how it will look like, there are two fuselages with the hydrogen tanks, and each one has an electric motor. And on the middle of the wing, between the two fuselage, you have a small cockpit for two pilots. That will be Raphael Di Nelli, who is a composite engineer and navigator from France, who is building the plane, and me, and we'll fly together and make shifts at the control.
And maybe what was the process like when you were coming up with this project and choosing the fuel type? Because obviously that's the big debate in any industry is what technology to bet on. And there are a few options in aviation, not so many, the batteries even. What led you to choosing hydrogen?
Batteries, I believe, will be used for small airplanes because it's very efficient. Almost all the electricity you put in goes out and feeds the motor. So it's an efficient way to use electricity. But of course, if you have a heavy airplane, it doesn't work because you would need to take inconsiderate amount of battery. And it would be far too heavy. So the other possibility is to take a normal airplane, completely normal, and put sustainable aviation fuel or electrofuel. That means a fuel that you do with the waste, or a fuel where you combine CO2 and green hydrogen, and it makes exactly an artificial chain of hydrocarbon like kerosene. But it's not really decarbonized, because you capture CO2, okay? You have this CO2 in your hands, and you could put it underground and get rid of it. But instead of that, you put it in the fuel and it goes back into the atmosphere. So it could be carbon negative, and it's actually not. So the only way I found, and that Airbus also found, and other people also, of course, to be fully decarbonized, that means to be outside of the cycle of carbon, is hydrogen. Because you will produce hydrogen with solar or wind or hydroelectricity, maybe even nuclear power. Some people will do hydrogen with nuclear power, especially during the night when nobody is using the electricity from nuclear power plants. But it means that you have a decarbonized source of hydrogen, because this electricity goes to hydrolyze water and you have the green hydrogen. And then this hydrogen, you can use it for trucks, can use it for trains, you can use it for whatever, for heavy transports, not for small cars who will have the batteries, probably. But of course, for airplanes, it's a big challenge, because you need to keep this hydrogen very cold, you need to have this big volume. So for airplanes, for example, when Airbus is presenting its program, you have the hydrogen tanks in the fuselage and you have the passengers in the wings. So you change completely the paradigm. And I like this. I like to go into these paradigm shifts. I like to go into these situations where people think it's impossible. And you look at all the skepticism, the people who say, oh, it will never happen. Like all the ones who criticized the beginning of aviation, the beginning of computers, the beginning of internet, the beginning of cell phones. Well, now they all look stupid, you know? So you need to be very, very careful before saying something has no future.
Where are these people now, I wonder? So we've gone over perhaps the objectives for this project. And as I mentioned at the top of the show, of course, this isn't your first time doing something paradigm shifting in terms of aviation and energy. Nearly 10 years ago, you flew around the world in a solar-powered aircraft with solar impulse. In the near decade since that happened, have you seen the objectives that you set for that project? Because I assume it wasn't just to go around the world in the plane. Of course, you had other objectives. Have you seen those objectives met? And have you seen the things that you wanted to achieve by that become a part of society?
Yeah, absolutely. Yes, absolutely. Because my goal with Solar Impulse was not to make a revolution in air transport. It was to make a revolution in the mindset of people regarding renewable energies, clean technologies, solutions to protect the environment in an economically profitable way. So that means solutions that can reconcile ecology and economy. So after the demonstration of Solar Impulse, my Solar Impulse Foundation has continued to work on identifying solutions everywhere in the world. And today we have selected and labeled almost 1,600 systems, products, material, devices, processes that can protect the environment and also represent a business opportunity for the industry, for technology, but also for the users. You know, if you have a way to reabsorb the heat that is lost in the chimney of the factory and give it back to the factory, you save on the energy bill as much as on the CO2 emissions. So the efficiency you gain pays for the upfront investment. And this is what I really mean with this qualitative economy, where all these solutions can be implemented and they create jobs, they help new companies to develop, and they help the users to have a better purchase power. Even poor people who today pay far too much in their energy bill because they have outdated lighting systems, outdated heating or cooling systems, badly insulated houses and things like that. And you help them to reduce their energy bill. Mm-hmm. And all these solutions that we identified, they come from all around the world. And they are useful for water, for energy, for mobility, construction, industry, agriculture, circular economy, waste management, IT, industry. And this is really what we need, you know, and tell to the people who say there's no future, well, there is a future with new solutions, with new jobs, with much better ways to do. And my target with all these solutions is to attract the world of economy, the world of industry, the world of politics, in order to show them that they can be much more ambitious in their energy and environmental policy because solutions are profitable.
Hi everyone, Sam here. Thanks for listening to the Policy Dispatch. Before we get on with the show, just a quick word on how you can access the rest of our unmissable and informative journalism on Foresight Climate and Energy. If you'd like to enjoy premium access to this or any of our other podcasts, as well as our in-depth articles, you can. You can try us for 30 days for less than €1 a day, which will give you access to our website and app. Just follow the link in the show notes or go to www.foresightmedia.com to find out more. Join our global community of listeners and readers today to stay informed, entertained, and in the know about all things climate and energy.
Yeah, in that near 10 years since Solar Impulse, I guess we've seen solar power just go from strength to strength in a lot of sectors. And do you consider Solar Impulse to have been even a small milestone in that journey of solar energy's revolution in a way?
In a way, yes. And I think the biggest compliment I got after the success of Solar Impulse is a European commissioner who said that Solar Impulse has changed the vision that the political world had over renewable energy, you know, to make it fashionable, to make it attractive. And there's another example that was so nice. In 2012, I made the first intercontinental flight with Solar Impulse, landing in Morocco. And we had the patronage of the King of Morocco, of all the people promoting solar energy in Morocco. And they explained me what happened. They said that all the remote villagers who had no access to electricity refused to have solar energy in the beginning. They wanted power lines, like everybody, because it makes serious, you know, it makes modern. Mm-hmm. And after our trip to Morocco with Solar Impulse, there was so much about our expedition in the media. The same people in the same villages went back to the government and said, you know, we don't want power lines. We want solar power, like on the plane, because it works. So in that sense, Solar Impulse was really a promotion for clean technologies. Of course, what also helped solar energy a lot is the drop in the production price, thanks to the Chinese industry. Because when it was made in Europe, it was 40 times more expensive than it is today. And the Chinese dropped the price dramatically. They destroyed the solar energy industry in Europe, but they, in a way, saved the world because now we have access to very cheap solar and wind power. Mm-hmm. So I would say Solar Impulse was really a way to make these renewable energies and these clean technologies more appealing, more trendy, more fashionable.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, the prestige element of that, I think, is particularly interesting. And it is really a qualitative thing, as you say, rather than something you can quantify. Maybe we could just say about the aspect of flight. This will be your trilogy of big endeavors using aviation in a way. Is there something specific about flight, you think, that makes it a perfect vector for this kind of changing of mindsets and changing paradigms that still captures people's imagination, even though getting on an airplane is not particularly exciting as maybe as it used to be for society? Do you think that flight still has that ability to capture our imaginations?
I think so. When you look at the history of aviation, since more than 100 years, aviation was always on the forefront of innovation, of disruption, and it has to continue. And I think flying is spectacular. You know, you can have a bicycle with hydrogen instead of a battery. You can have a boat with hydrogen to cross the English Channel. But I don't think it will be as appealing as an aeroplane flying around the world nonstop. So this is why I choose aviation, to make it spectacular. If it is spectacular, people look at it and they say, wow, if you can do it in the hardest vehicle to be decarbonized, of course, there's a future. And in that sense, you have a lot of people who want to ban aviation because it pollutes. Well, it pollutes 3% of the CO2 emissions in the world. So it's 3% too much. But we have to remember that there are 97% that are done by other things, and we also have to address them. But instead of banning aviation, we have to prove that aviation can become clean, decarbonized, more efficient. And this climate impulse, in that sense, really has the ambition to bring a revolution in aviation, very practically speaking. And we can be a little bit like the demonstrator that the project of Airbus is credible and reliable, and that it will happen, because you also need to show to the customers, people buying airplanes, but also people traveling in airplanes, that there is an interesting alternative to kerosene.
Mm-hmm. We obviously, all of us, learn quite a lot from our experiences, no matter how small or outlandish they are, I guess. If you could go back to the Bertrand Piccard of 1999 and 2015, when you were doing these first two projects, is there anything that you would tell them that you learned from those two that you think would have been indispensable to know at the time? Or do you think that you have no regrets about how you went about these projects and how you could have maybe done them better?
Well, you can always do better, but I think I learned from my failures so much also. I don't think Breitling Orbiter 3 would have been such a big success without the failures of the two first ones. And what I learned is patience, perseverance, and also changing the strategy at every failure to make it better. My major competitors, like Steve Fossett, like Richard Branson, and others, they tried each time exactly the same way, and they failed for the same reasons. Mm-hmm. I learned from my failure, and I changed the type of fuel, the strategy, the technology, sometimes even the crew, in order to be always better. So this is really what I learned from the Breitling Orbiter success. Mm-hmm. And then Solar Impulse. Mm-hmm. Solar Impulse, when I initiated the project, I was facing all the official aviation industry, and the specialists were laughing. Mm-hmm. And I was reading in the newspapers, this is a completely useless project. It's only for the ego of Bertrand Piccard, who wants to fly in a gigantic airplane. And well, you need to cope with all this stupid criticism until you succeed. But if you fail, it means the others are right. So it's heavy on the shoulders, you know, really heavy. And all the people who were criticizing, also in newspapers, you never heard them after the success. And now with Climate Impulse, I see that there are less people who dare to laugh. Uh-huh. And I feel this also with the support that I have from the industry. We have the first main partner of this project, ScienceCo, who is a spin-off from Solvay. So Solvay was helping me for Solar Impulse. And when I called them for Climate Impulse, they said immediately, absolutely, we come like the first time. And it's a loyalty that is fantastic. You know, ScienceCo is a chemical company for the materials for the future, special carbon fiber, composites, insulation for hydrogen tanks, fuel cells, and solid-state batteries and things like that. But also airplane companies. I have the support of Airbus, of Daher, of Ariane Group, sending rockets to space. Well, they also support us. It's really interesting to see the consensus that the industry has around this climate impulse project. And of course, there's a track record of success behind me. But I think there's also this attempt to have a track record of success in front of us. And this pulls in the project and attracts a lot of pioneers. Mm-hmm. This is what I love in a project like this. You have no lazy people joining a project like that. Mm-hmm. You have only skills, talented innovators, people who want to bring solutions, answer to the questions. You know, they use the doubts and the question marks to stimulate their creativity and their performance. And this is wonderful. I love these situations where there is no benchmark, nobody can help you. And in the team, we just have to invent the future.
Mm-hmm. Is it fair to say that Solar Impulse didn't enjoy that same kind of support and backing from the aviation industry in a way? And like you said, your track record now is speaking for itself, and that's why the sector is taking a little bit more notice and being a little less skeptical.
Yes. Yeah, absolutely. With Solar Impulse, the airplane constructors were laughing, and they said the plane will never fly. And you know, I even have a diagram with a line showing that if an airplane is small, it is light. If an airplane is big, it's heavy. And there is a line, you know, showing exactly the progression and the relation between weight and wingspan. And they told us Solar Impulse cannot happen, cannot exist, because it is big and light. So it's outside of the line. And I love this story because it was the scientific proof that what we have done was impossible. Mm-hmm. And from then on, I never listen to people anymore if they say it's impossible. I ask them, is it maybe difficult? Okay, maybe it's difficult, but it's not impossible. And when they say it's impossible, I say, yeah, it's only because we have not yet found the way to do it. But if we find the way to do it, it will not be impossible anymore. So we just have to change our mindset. We need to understand that the impossible does not exist in the reality. It exists only in the mindset of the people who want to keep the status quo, to think in the way they have always done. But as long as you are an explorer and a pioneer, your goal is to destroy the status quo. Your goal is to go outside of the common assumptions, outside of the rules that have prevailed until today, to invent other rules or to discover other rules. Mm-hmm. So it's fascinating. I love these projects.
Speaking about the status quo, I guess if we look at this year in particular, 2024 is a huge year for elections around the world, the United States, the European Union, India, and so on. Do you think that our current model of democracy, the way that we've been doing things for a long time, this status quo, is able to facilitate the kind of changes that you'd like to see in society to actually bring about these paradigm shifts that are necessary to meet things like the Paris Agreement and to make sure that huge parts of our world are not become inhospitable in the near future? Or do you think there needs to be a change to that as well?
You know, you have some people who say democracy is not able to address the climate change issues because there are too many oppositions, too many different opinions. But of course, if you have a strong government who really addresses the problem of climate change and puts in place solutions that will help the ecology, the purchase power of the poorest people, the development of the economy, and sovereignty in energy independence and things like that. Of course, you can say, wow, that's wonderful. This government has done it. But there's not more reason to have a strong government to do it than a democracy, because maybe the strong government will do exactly the opposite. You know, maybe the strong government will not believe in climate change issues and will just develop coal power plants or oil power plants or gas or whatever. So I don't think it's a question that it's better to have strong governments or democracy for climate change, because democracy is a way where we can be sure that the human rights are well protected. In a democracy, you can be sure that there is more things done for the poorest people against the inequalities. There are more integration of the diversity of people. So I don't think we have to think this way. I think we have to show that whoever has the power, green, left, right, extreme right, or center, the ecology should not be a hostage of the politic. Because each party has something to gain from the ecological transition. As we said before, it's purchase power for the poorest people, it's protection of the environment, it's development of the economy, new business opportunities, new jobs created, energy independence. This is something we forget. If we create our own electricity locally with solar, wind, biomass, geothermia, hydroelectricity, it is much safer than to buy oil and gas in strange countries abroad. So each political party has an advantage in the ecological transition. And this is really my message. This is why my Solar Impulse Foundation has published a manifesto for Europe, showing all the advantage in going into the efficiency, going into modernization of our world to be cleaner and at the same time more profitable. But please, people really have to understand that each time you have a cleavage, each time ecology is hostage, then it is attacked from both sides and things will never move and things will never improve.
Mm-hmm. Maybe just a final question to wrap up the episode, Bertrand. This is the third time that you've done this kind of project. I think I know the answer already, but are you as equally excited about this flight as you were about the other two? Or even more, even?
Even more. Mm-hmm. Even more, I think, because the first time it was my personal dream mm-hmm. with Breitling Orbiter Balloon. Second time it was this message with Solar Impulse for clean energy, but it was symbolic. This time with Climate Impulse, a hydrogen airplane flying nonstop around the world with two people on board, it's really disruptive in terms of development of aviation. So it's very, very practical. So I think it makes a nice trilogy, all the three together. And I hope it will be a trilogy with a third success also, of course.
Sequels can be good, remember. They don't have to be not as good as the original. Bertrand, many thanks for joining me for the discussion today. It was an absolute pleasure to talk to you and learn about your new endeavor going to help the energy transition. I wish you all the best for your preparations with Climate Impulse. And I really cannot wait to see how this new adventure pans out and the impact that it has on society as well, as we discussed.
Thank you, Sam. Very happy to share my passion with you.
This has to be a contender for one of my favorite episodes of the show. The Climate Impulse Project brings a hefty dose of optimism and energy at a time when we desperately need a bit of oomph. Many things that were once thought impossible in the energy sector are now anything but. Will Bertrand's hydrogen flight indeed help change those mindsets we talked about in the episode? Let's hope so. Just before I go, I owe you the answer to the quiz question. Bertrand Piccard's hot air balloon flight set the world record for longest unrefueled flight time. Still stands today. How long was the aircraft up in the skies? The correct answer is 19 days, 21 hours, and 17 minutes. I can actually still remember seeing news updates as a kid and reading about it in my copy of the Guinness Book of World Records. Amazing stuff. Many thanks for joining me for today's show. I'll be back soon with another episode and another trip through the fascinating world of the energy transition.